MechCast, Monday, December 24th, 2012. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Happy holidays. Welcome to the MechCast. I guess, you know, some people are last-minute holiday shoppers. That is not me. I get my holiday shopping done pretty early, so I was pretty prepared on that front. But the holidays always kind of sneak up on you, don't they? And you've got like a million things going on. So looks like I'm a last-minute holiday podcaster. I'm getting this show out to you here on Christmas Eve. I hope it finds you warm and well and happy and having a good time with friends and family as you should be. And we've got lots of great things to talk about. I will tell you a little bit light on the feedback. I guess many of you are probably busy as well. Didn't get a lot of questions and comments this week. I have one little tip for you, and then I want to talk about maybe some things you can do with that brand new iOS device you're hopefully getting for the holidays. But we have that and a whole bunch of news to get into. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, and that is Smile. Actually, there's some exciting news from Smile right now. If you want to get a copy of PDF Pen for the iPhone or PDF Pen for the iPad, now is the time to do it. They're actually having a sale through the end of the year, an awesome price on both these apps. A great gift for yourself this holiday season. So PDF Pen for iPad is now just $6.99. It's regularly $14.99 US, and PDF Pen for iPhone is just $1.99, down from the regular $4.99 price. So more than half off of these awesome applications. And it's great because you can use them to edit, markup, fill out PDF forms, sign PDFs on the go. I have both these apps. I paid for them. They are awesome. You just need to have them in your collection. And for me, one of the key features is that they have iCloud and Dropbox integration. So if you have PDF Pen for your Mac, you can always have access to your documents and your PDFs when and where you need them and work on those things. And it just is so convenient. And, you know, on that note, don't forget to pick up the desktop applications as well. Smile has PDF Pen for the Mac, which is awesome. Also, Text Expander Touch for your iOS device and Text Expander and Disk Label for the Mac. So, all fabulous products. You should check them all out over at smilesoftware.com. But at the very least, make sure you grab your copies of PDF Pen for your iOS devices. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MechCast. So let's get into some of the Apple news for the past week. Looks like Apple has begun construction on their expansion of their Texas operations. Apple started construction on a 1 million square foot operations facility in Texas. Actually, it's going to be multiple operations facilities. The facility expansion is in addition to existing operations that Apple has in Texas, where they currently employ about 3,500 workers. The new operation is expected to generate 3,600 new jobs over the next 10 years. It's actually going to be completed in two phases. The current phase is a 200,000 square foot facility that's going to comprise two buildings. It's going to cost Apple about $56 million to build, and it is expected to be completed by the end of 2015. The second phase is due to complete by 2021 and will involve a larger 800,000 square foot set of facilities spread across multiple buildings. The report I was reading didn't say exactly how many buildings, but all in all, Apple's expected to spend about $304 million on the expansion, and they're getting about $30 million in tax breaks for the project from the state and local governments. The project actually was almost scrapped back in April when they ran into some approval issues with one of the local governments in Travis County, but they did eventually reach an agreement. Apple agreed to make the average salary for workers at the new facility at least $35,000. That's for the bottom 10% of workers. And they also agreed that the project contractors would get a minimum hourly rate of $11 per hour. That kind of settled things with the county, and they were able to proceed. They broke ground this week and will be expanding that new operation in Texas. Told you last time in the MacCast that Google has finally released its Google Maps application for iOS, and tons of people have downloaded that thing. As a matter of fact, Google reported that in the first 48 hours of the release of Google Maps for iOS, it had over 10 million downloads. And not long after that, we started getting reports that iOS 6 adoption was up, many believing that it was due in part to Google releasing Maps for the iOS. So far, the app has been met with very positive reviews from pundits like David Pogue and Walt Mossberg. And as a matter of fact, Google themselves have come out and said that they think the iOS version is actually better than Google Maps currently on the Android platform. Of course, they're going to be sprucing things up over on that side as well. But kind of the big news came in this week with some numbers from an ad network called MoPub. They took data from some of the 12,000 iOS applications that they support, and they claim that they saw about a 29% increase in the number of devices running iOS 6 in the 5 days just following the release of Google Maps. Now, they suggested that the data was due to the large number of iOS users who were holding off on upgrading to iOS 6 because of the whole Maps debacle and the subsequent negative press that Apple's version of iOS Maps received. As a matter of fact, Tim Cook had to come out and apologize publicly for Maps and say that they were working on improving them. But the study from MoPub definitely is up to debate. The ad service Chitika ran a similar report just a day and a half after the release of Google Maps, and they found that iOS 6 usage had jumped just about 0.2%. So in Chitika's numbers, they weren't showing the big increase, and the reason for the discrepancy could be, or was speculated by some, that the MoPub data is actually a much larger and broader sample size because they're global, and also they had run it for a longer period, about 5 days. But then Chitika came back and with some numbers for the 6 day period following the release of Google Maps, and they said the numbers continued to be flat. Now, they speculate the reason for the discrepancy is that MoPub was actually seeing the numbers for the iPhone launching in China. The Chitika numbers only represent US and Canada, whereas MoPub, as I said, is a global sampling of those numbers. And Apple launched the iPhone in China around the same time as the release of Google Maps. As a matter of fact, China and 32 other countries on December 17th. And Apple came out and reported that in the opening weekend just for China, they had sold over 2 million phones. So my guess is that the reason for the uptick is likely a mix of both things happening, the launch of the iPhone in many more countries, and a certain number of consumers jumping on the iOS 6 bandwagon now that Google Maps was available. I'm thinking, though, that the iPhone launch is a larger percentage of that spike and why it did show up so much more in the MoPub numbers versus the Chitika ones. It's been a knockdown, drag out, bang up year for patent lawsuits, especially for Apple and some of its competitors. But believe it or not, a lot of those same folks came together recently to scoop up a number of Kodak's imaging patents. Kodak announced this week that it would be selling more than 1,100 patents related to the capture, manipulation, and sharing of digital images to a group led by Intellectual Ventures Management LLC and RPX Corporation. The deal was actually backed by 12 companies, including Apple, Google, Research in Motion, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, and others. Apple and the others will license the patents in the deal and, as a result, resolve a lot of their patent infringement lawsuits that were coming from Kodak. Actually, by splitting the deal with the 12 other parties, Apple not only gets to pay just a portion of the $525 million deal, but it also avoids having to go to court on patent infringement claims being made by Kodak, claims in which Kodak alleged that Apple owed them more than $1 billion in patent royalties. So Apple's going to save a little bit of money had they had to go to court. So it sounds like a big win for Apple and the other partners, but this deal also does help Kodak, who filed for bankruptcy protection back in January. Kodak still retains 9,600 other patents and has been working on gaining this financing to help them exit bankruptcy in the first half of 2013 and hopefully work on rebuilding the company. Since Apple announced moving its iOS devices to the new 9-pin Lightning connector, moving away from the 30-pin connector, there's been a lot of discussion and debate about when we would start seeing accessories from third-party manufacturers. A big part of that happening was those manufacturers getting some of the new rules and regulations from the made-for-iPhone guidelines that Apple published about a month or so ago. And since then, we've been seeing a steady stream of devices, and there have been some really innovative products showing up on the market. This week, we heard about a multi-device Kickstarter charging station project that drew quite a bit of attention because of a restriction that they came across with the Made for iPhone guidelines. It looked to actually prevent the fully funded project from actually reaching consumers. The product was called the Pop Charging Station, and it was going to offer both Lightning and 30-pin connectors as well as USB charging ports, all in a single universal charging solution device that would support multiple devices, not just iOS devices, but Android devices included. So it had full funding, and it was going to be able to support multiple generations of Apple products, including older devices that use the 30-pin connectors. But the developers hit a snag this week when Apple told them that they could not move forward with the project because of the Made for iPhone guidelines, which allow for devices that mix USB and Lightning connectors, but actually specifically prohibited any devices that would include both Lightning and 30-pin connectors. For their part, the Pop Station developers posted on their Kickstarter blog that due to the restrictions, they were going to have to cancel the product because they didn't want to make any compromises in the product's functionality. And to that end, they planned to fully refund all of the money for the Kickstarter backers and kill the project. As a matter of fact, in order to do that, because Kickstarter has no mechanism for offering refunds, the developers went ahead and built their entirely own system for actually processing refunds, and they were going to eat the Kickstarter fees in order to be able to facilitate that, which that is just that's an amazing thing on the part of the Kickstarter developers. I haven't ever heard that being done with any other kind of Kickstarter project. Usually the money just kind of obliviates and goes off into the ether and no one ever sees it again, nor do they ever see the project. So I thought them stepping up like that was a great move. And they, of course, appealed to Apple and also got some attention from the press this week. And it looks like that did help, or at very least, maybe Apple was paying attention, because the PR team responded saying that the restrictions that were in place were due to some technical issues that prevented accessories from integrating 30-pin and Lightning connectors together. They really didn't give any details on what those technical limitations would be, but fortunately, there seems like there might be a happy ending for everyone. Apple did also announce that they had resolved those technical issues and now have updated the guidelines to allow products that can have both 30-pin and Lightning connectors to support charging. The Pop product team responded saying that the guidelines have if the guidelines have indeed been changed, then the project would definitely be back on. But they were a little bit cautious because so far the announcement of the change has only come from the Apple PR team and not the Made for iPhone group, which is the one that's ultimately going to have to approve the product. So they're being cautiously hesitant. That's a bit redundant. Cautiously optimistic. And I would imagine that we won't hear about anything with respect to the project till after the holidays, because everybody's kind of shut down. But I think we're ultimately going to see a positive resolution. And it's good news for other accessory makers, especially when you want to support multiple devices and multiple generations of Apple devices moving forward with a single product. So I have a feeling we'll be seeing more of these hybrid type products now that they have changed those guidelines. Pre-orders of the awesome new 27-inch iMacs started arriving over the past couple of weeks, at least for those consumers lucky enough to pre-order and get early in on the list. But they're showing up and they're getting pretty rave reviews, and most customers are very happy, although there are some new iMac owners who are ending up frustrated when they discover that they can't run Windows on their shiny new machine, at least not through boot camp. Now, this is a pretty isolated issue. It only impacts owners who opted for the 27-inch model with the 3 terabyte Fusion Drive upgrade, but it is a pretty obscure little thing that most people probably didn't notice when they were ordering. As a matter of fact, Apple just has a note in it, or a note about the limitation in its Fusion Drive support documents, which you'd kind of have to go seek out. It's not really easy to find. I'll have a link to the full limitations in the show notes at maccast.com. But for some reason, there's a technical limitation just with the 3 terabyte Fusion Drive that will not support Boot Camp. Some other limitations that Fusion Drive owners might have missed and might want to be aware of is that you can only have one partition on a Fusion Drive hard disk. Also, you can only mount a Fusion Drive in target disk mode if you have a system, if you're mounting it on a system running OS X Mountain Lion 10.8.2 or later. So if you needed to go back and try and run that in target disk mode on an older Mac, that is not going to work, or at least when running an older version of the operating system. And also, if you're doing a video capture project and you're having to capture a large amount of video and you have the video capture exceed the capacity of the 128 gigabytes of flash storage that the Fusion Drive offers, you could start to get frame dropouts as it switches over to having to use the traditional HDD portion of the storage. You remember, Fusion Drive will always try to write to the faster SSD flash, but you only have 128 gigabytes of that, and maybe less depending upon what kinds of applications you have loaded in the system. So Apple recommends, if you're going to do that, that you capture your video in smaller portions, but that might not be a viable solution for people doing really heavy video applications. So I think Fusion Drive is an amazing technology, can really increase performance in certain situations, but it's probably good if you're considering purchasing one to go through that little support document, look at some of the limitations and gotchas. There's also a troubleshooting guide in there, and again, I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check that out. I think I had told you last time about the iOS 6.0.2 update coming out to address some Wi-Fi issues that people are having. Well, some issues this week started reporting seeing rapid battery loss on their iOS devices after applying the iOS 6.0.2 update. So it may have come at a cost. Now, it's not 100% certain what's going on, and it's not looking like all users are impacted, but one theory is that it may be the devices are scanning for Wi-Fi networks more frequently or using more power while doing so, and that could be a source of the battery drain. Some people are saying that the battery loss seems to be happening more frequently when they're traveling or when they're away from their home Wi-Fi networks, and the prediction is that it might be seeking out and trying to connect to various Wi-Fi hotspots as you're traveling along, particularly if you're in a car in a populated area. I've had this happen to me before. You know, it's always constantly scanning and you'll see different Wi-Fi networks pop up, and it could be the fact that it's trying to hit those Wi-Fi networks maybe more aggressively that's causing the battery loss. Other users say it may just simply be something that we've seen in the past as well with updates where it's a visual bug, just a problem with the battery indicator or the battery percentage indicator. One user reported seeing his battery drop to 4% and then stay at 4% for several hours with the battery indicator really not changing at all. I personally have applied the update to all of my iOS devices, and I haven't really noticed a difference in the battery life. Let me know how you've been doing, if you've run across this bug, and maybe if you have a solution or a workaround. I would imagine one potential workaround, if it turns out to be the case where it's searching for Wi-Fi networks more aggressively, might be that when you're away from a known Wi-Fi network, to simply disable your Wi-Fi and then turn it back on. Apple is reportedly aware of the issue and is supposedly investigating it. I don't know if they've confirmed that there is a bug yet, but they apparently are looking into it. So I would imagine if they do find something, we should see a fix come in the next update. Now that we're approaching the end of 2012, it looks like a number of researchers and reporters are going back and looking to see how consumer electronics and technology have done over the past year, including how we've seen growth in smartphones and tablets. TechCrunch reports on a Forrester Research published report called The State of Consumers and Technology that looks at all of technology over the past year. It has some interesting numbers and figures in it, and surprisingly, or not surprisingly, it shows that there was significant growth in the tablet market over the past year. The study found that 19% of U.S. consumers now have a tablet device, and that is a number that is doubled over the numbers for 2011. They also had some interesting numbers that showed that there's proof that Apple needs to probably get more serious about the TV business over the next year. They did a study or had numbers that showed that 43% of consumers now connect to the web through their television sets. That shocked me a little bit. I wouldn't think there would have been that many, but when you look at how people are doing it, it makes a lot more sense. They said that 42% of consumers are using their game consoles to connect to the web or the internet. 19% are using connected television sets that have been released over the past year. So that would be sets that include things like Google TV integrated into them, or even just Netflix and other services, Hulu and what have you, built into them. And then they found that 14%, just 14% of consumers are using a set-top box like an Apple TV or a Roku device. So it's not necessarily that I think consumers are connecting to the web, quote unquote, to do web surfing, but if you look at online streaming services like Netflix and Hulu, and now Redbox just announced their partnership with Verizon, those are the kinds of things that people are accessing using these different devices and boxes. And for sure, at this point, game consoles seem to be the preferred way for people to connect. I'm thinking that Apple's going to want to capitalize on that growth over the next year, and that's why we're hearing them change their position on Apple TV, moving from a hobby to something of quote-unquote serious interest. Is that how Tim Cook put it? And, you know, I'm hesitant that Apple is going to put out a full-blown HD TV set, at least not in the early part of this year. I could see it happening in the later part of the year, although we had some reports this week saying that Apple won't get a set out until 2014. I think looking at numbers like this, they might have to step up that release schedule a bit more if that's truly what it is. We're really just speculating all at this point, so we'll have to see how it plays out in 2013. But certainly those numbers are showing it's a serious area of growth and something that a lot of people are going to want to be getting into. As far as smartphone goes, we had some interesting end-of-the-year numbers from Nielsen. They show that U.S. ownership of smartphones has finally surpassed the usage of feature phones. Their study noted that smartphone ownership at the start of the year for U.S. consumers was at 49%, but that it had grown to about 56% by the end of the third quarter. So smartphones have finally crossed over that line and are now the dominant and preferred devices, at least among U.S. consumers. On the OS front, the study also found that Android was accounting for about 52% of the market, with iOS accounting for 35%. BlackBerry came in third with 7% market share, and Windows Phone after that with about 2%. The rest of the operating systems made up about 5% of the market share. And that was for the whole of 2012. If you slice up the numbers a little bit smaller and look at just the last 12 weeks of the year, you get a little bit different perspective, at least in terms of the OS share and where it's trending. Kantar World Panel ComTech released numbers for the last 12 weeks of U.S. smartphone sales, and they show that the iPhone is trending upward and actually gaining a slight edge in market share over Android. According to their findings, they found that the iPhone now has 53% of the U.S. smartphone market, with Android at 42%. So Apple is now, once again, the dominant smartphone in the U.S. market, and Apple and Android seem to flip-flop back and forth on that. I was considered to be a little bit more impressive on the Apple front, considering they just have the one phone. Well, you can technically say it's three phones with the iPhone 5, the 4S, and the 4, but really just iPhone device versus the myriad of Android devices that are out on the market. I think the upward trend for Apple in the back half of the year has a lot to do with the timing of the release of the iPhone 5 right before the holiday season. They generated a lot of hype and have been able to sell a lot of devices here in the back half of the year. So you have to remember that the Kantar report is just looking at the last 12 weeks of U.S. smartphone sales. The study does also note, however, that despite the large or the significant growth in the U.S. market, the growth for Apple in the European market is a little bit smaller. They just increased their share 2.5% and captured about 25.3% of the European market. That's versus Android's dominant share in that region of 61%. And then finally, in the news for this week, or actually in the rumors for this week, some news that might be a little bit hard to hear, especially for those of you who just got a shiny new iPad or iPad mini for the holidays. If some rumors are to be believed, Apple could be grinching it up for you in the spring. RBC Capital Market analyst Doug Freeman said he was touring chip factories in China, and he thinks it looks like Apple could be moving up production of the next generation iPad mini, which is rumored to be adding a Retina display, something that many people were hoping would have been in the current model, but didn't end up being there. Here's the thing, though. He does not have a firm idea or does not say when Apple would be planning on releasing the next version of the mini, so just saying that they're stepping up production or moving up the release schedule really doesn't tell us all that much. Another thing that Freeman noted when he was in the region was that Texas Instruments does seem to be one of the chip suppliers being asked to produce components for the next mini and move up those schedules. I'm not exactly sure that there are any Texas Instruments chips in the current generation mini, so I find that a little bit interesting. Although Texas Instruments has done the touch screen controller chips for at least the iPad 2, I'm not sure if they do current chips in the current 9.7-inch iPad, but Apple also has used Texas Instruments integrated circuits in the new Lightning cables and Lightning connectors. So Texas Instruments certainly is a chip partner of Apple's, and it wouldn't be surprising that they would be making chips for future generations of the iPad. And if you want to believe the Japanese blog Mac Takahara, they seem to confirm that Apple is looking to release new iPads relatively soon. They've been right on some Apple rumors in the past, so I tend to give them a favorable rating when it comes to Mac rumors, and they're saying that Apple is planning on updating the iPads in March, or as soon as March. They sort of confirm that the iPad mini would be getting a Retina screen update, and their blog also says that Apple's looking to update the 9.7-inch iPad to make it thinner, lighter, and bring it in line design-wise with the iPad mini and the iPhone 5. So I would assume that would mean a move from the aluminum back to the anodized back that we see on the black iPad, so the black back and the anodized aluminum back on the white model. And that seems to be relatively quickly, again, after the release of just the fourth generation iPad, which came just 8 months after the release of the third generation iPad. So Apple, if this turns out to be true, is really stepping up the schedule of things. Now, there was one little odd thing in the Mac Takahara report that I think does cast a little shadow of doubt on the validity of their rumor. They're saying that the iPad mini would also get a processor bump moving to the Apple A6X processor, which is the same one that's in the current generation 9.7-inch iPad. That's going to use a lot more power, and it seems like the Apple wouldn't be able to cram that in an iPad mini and still maintain the same battery capacity, at least not without significantly changing the battery technology that's in the mini. And it would seem like if they had that kind of technology, or were even close to that kind of technology, that they would have already made that move. I don't know, we'll have to wait and see, but certainly if you've purchased a new iPad mini, it might be a little bit disappointing to see new ones coming out so soon after the last generation models. At this point, though, I'm not putting anything past Apple. They've done it now in the past, they have a precedent set for it, and I think they could go ahead and move to this sort of biannual iPad update cycle. As much as it might alienate consumers at first, I think we will eventually get used to that release cycle. It also does give Apple, I think, a little bit more flexibility to update their products as new technologies and new manufacturing cycles allow them to do so. And that could allow them to stay up with, or at least ahead of, the competition, who are already using more aggressive product cycles to kind of combat Apple's dominant market share. So it may be something, or a sort of case where Apple's hands being forced a little bit to move to this more aggressive release cycle, because they do occasionally get complaints that, oh, Android has leapfrogged them, or this device or that device is now using a better processor, or a better screen technology that became available maybe after the release of the last generation of iPads. So we'll have to see in 2013 whether they continue to step things up, but I definitely say it wouldn't surprise me as much as it might be a little bit hard to take, at least at first. And so with that, that is going to be the news for this week. Now I want to talk to you a little bit about email that I received from Phil, and he was looking for a way to save Instagram photos directly off of his iOS device, but not his photos, because, you know, that's pretty straightforward. When you take a photo with Instagram, it's actually automatically saved to your camera roll, or you can move it to your camera roll on your device. But what Phil wanted to do was save the full resolution photo of somebody maybe he was following on Instagram. And I thought, well, this has got to be something that's relatively easy to do, right? You should be able to maybe just copy and paste the image out of the Instagram app. My investigation, I was not able to find a very easy way to save someone else's photos, at least not directly from the iOS app. They seem to be pretty well protected as far as I can tell. And while there might be a simpler way, I thought I'd share with you and with you, Phil, how I was able to figure out how to do it. So this is the procedure I went through. It does seem a little bit convoluted, but it ended up with the result I think you want to get to. So what I did was in Instagram on iOS, I located the image I wanted to save, and I clicked the little ellipses, the little dot, dot, dot button at the bottom. That brought up the option for me to send a tweet with that image in it. So I clicked on the tweet option, and then when the tweet sheet dropped down, there is a link in there. There's an Instagram link, and I was able to copy that link and save it off, but I did not send out the tweet. I just canceled at that point and exited the Instagram application. Then I went over to the Mail app and emailed myself that link, because in order to do the next part of this, I had to use Safari on the Mac. I wasn't able to figure out a way to get this to work in mobile Safari. So I went back to my Mac, I opened up the link in Safari on the Mac, and for this next part to work, you do need to have the developer menu enabled. This is how you're going to be able to get to the actual source image file that displays over on Instagram. So make sure that you have the developer options enabled in Safari on the Mac. So you want to go into the preferences under advanced, and you want to make sure you've checked on the show developer menu in menu bar. Once you've done that, you should in Safari see a little menu called developer, and that's how you know you have it enabled. So go ahead and open the link that you sent in that email in Safari. And then what you're going to do is you're going to right-click or control-click on the image in the Safari window and choose Inspect Element. And from that point, you should see the web inspector. And in there, you can see the image URL, which is in there as a background image. And at that point, you can double-click on that URL and then select the URL. And at that point, you can copy and paste the URL back into the Safari location bar. Told you this was a little bit convoluted. And at that point, you will have just the image up in a window in Safari, and you can drag that image out, or you can control click or right click on that image, choose save as, and save that wherever you want. And then at that point, you have the full resolution image. You can do whatever you want with it. Now, if all this sounds a little bit too complicated or a little bit too convoluted, I would love to find out if there's some other simpler way to do what Phil wants to do. If you have an idea how to do that, please shoot me an email, send me a message, maccast@gmail.com. Another option that you could use just in iOS, and it would make it really simple, is just take a screenshot of the image once you have it up on your phone or your iPad by simply pressing the home and sleep wake button at the same time. The only issue there is you're going to end up with a low-res copy, and Phil specifically told me he wanted the high-res original version of that image as it was uploaded to Instagram. So my procedure does allow you to get at the source image, or at least the highest quality image that is available on the Instagram service. So that's how I figured out how to do it. It did come up this week that there are a few other ways if you want to save off your own Instagram photos and get those out of Instagram. Instagram, again, doesn't make that very easy to do, but there was a whole thing that went down this week. Instagram was acquired by Facebook a while back. I don't know if you heard this story, but then Facebook this week went through and was going to change Instagram's privacy policies. A lot of people got upset because what they wanted to do was make the images basically owned by Facebook, saying that they could use them in advertising that you granted them a non-exclusive license to use and resell those images without having to compensate you in any way. It was actually a pretty egregious thing. And so a lot of people were up in arms. A lot of people were looking at ways to pull their images off of Instagram, get out of the service, and cancel their accounts. So subsequently, what happened was there were a lot of sites that popped up, or a lot of different articles on how to get your images out of Instagram. So one site I found is called Instaport. It's actually web2.instaport.me. It allows you to download all your images and have them sent to you in a zip file. There was another service that cropped up. This one is called Free the Photos at freethephotos.com. And that service allows you to plug in your Instagram account information as well as your Flickr account information, and will transfer all of your images over from Instagram to Flickr. Now, the one caveat and warning I have about both of these services is they do require you to log in, or at least use an OAuth to authorize access to your Instagram account, and in the case of the second service, to your Flickr account. So if you're not comfortable with that, you may want to avoid these services and look for some sort of other solution for extracting your images from Instagram. These were the only two that I could find. If you do know of a way to actually pull your images off of Instagram that I missed or didn't come across, please shoot me an email and let me know about those. But for their part, Instagram did come back and rescind their changes to their privacy policy after the whole uproar. They came back and said, okay, we really didn't want access to all of your images. We didn't want ownership of those images. Those images are yours. You get to keep them. And they have pulled back. They reverted the privacy policy, and they're reviewing and looking at the language that they used and are going to change it, supposedly, to make it a little less egregious, at least in terms of the ownership front. We'll have to see if that really happens once they release the final privacy policy, but they did at least roll back on that a little bit, which has calmed down some of the excitement that was going on. You know, the idea of these services just owning your photos, I think in a lot of cases what happens here is the lawyers get a hold of these privacy policies. Instagram, in this case, had their own in place, and people were pretty comfortable with it. Of course, Facebook, having acquired it, probably had their lawyers go through, and they try and make the policies as broad as possible. So I'm sure that no one really reviewed it. They just had the lawyers look it over. The lawyers made this really broad policy. They threw it out there. And of course, the public looked at it and said, hey, wait a minute, this is not good for us. You guys aren't doing the right thing. And it's good that they were called out on it. And it just goes to prove that, you know, we should probably be reading these policies. A lot of it's legalese, though. It's hard for just the average consumer, the end user, to really realize what's going on. So I think it's good that we have some smart people in the tech industry and in the public eye, or in the tech media, really looking over these things, or taking the time to look over these things and call this sort of stuff to the public's attention, so that we can give the feedback to the companies and say, hey, this isn't right. You need to change this. And it obviously worked in this situation, I think, to the good of everyone who likes to use services like Instagram and Facebook and things like that. So hopefully that kind of trend continues. But Phil, I hope that helps you save off your images and maybe helps some of the rest of you figure out how to get your photos and save those off of Instagram if you didn't save them as you were kind of going along and uploading them to the service. And then the last thing that I want to talk to you about today is, if you are getting a new iOS device for the holidays, a question that I get asked a lot is, what do I recommend in terms of accessories, in terms of add-on products, in terms of applications to sort of get you up and off the ground and started with these new devices? I know a lot of you already have these devices, but I'm sure many of you are going to be getting them as your first iOS device, your first iPad or your iPhone. And I wanted to kind of address those questions that I often get in email. And probably the first and foremost, and this is something that I typically wouldn't have recommended in the past, but as someone who had his new iPad and iPhone befall a very tragic fate this year, and if you didn't hear that episode, I had a situation where I left my iPhone and iPad on top of my car and drove off. They were run over and completely destroyed. And AppleCare, and specifically now AppleCare Plus, or any kind of third-party protection plan that will protect you against accidental damage, those were things in the past that I typically didn't buy with my iOS devices. But I would urge you to look into and at least consider with your new iOS device. And the reason I say it's not a blanket yes you must buy and you probably want to consider it is you just need to look at how accident prone are you and how devastated or how hard would it be for you to replace a device if you had to pay full boat for that. This is, I think, specifically significant if you're getting a subsidized device, a subsidized iPad, maybe a 4G iPad, and you're getting a subsidy from the carrier, or an iPhone. It can be very expensive to replace that, and some of these third-party accidental damage protection programs, as well as Apple's AppleCare Plus, can really take the sting out of having to make that replacement. So with AppleCare, it's going to cost you $99. It's going to cover you for, I think, two years total, so an additional year just on your standard AppleCare. So should, you know, anything happen in terms of defect, the screen break, Apple's going to cover that. But more importantly, you get that accidental damage protection, which means that if you drop your iPad, you do something stupid like leave it on top of your car and it gets run over, you can pay a $50 deductible and Apple is going to go ahead and replace that device for you. The one thing to know about the AppleCare Plus plan is there's a couple little caveats. If you read the fine print, and I went in and looked at this, there's certain situations where there's kind of discretion on the part of the genius or the people that you take it into at the Apple Store to determine whether or not they're going to cover it under the accidental damage. One of those things is I don't think for water damage, they cover the kind of thing where, you know, it got splashed on or you drop it in a puddle or something like that, but it does not cover full immersion. So if you're out boating and that thing falls to the bottom of the sea, or you're swimming in your swimming pool and it falls in and sits there at the bottom of the pool for a while, they may or may not cover that in terms of the accidental damage. I'm curious to hear if anybody's had personal experience with that. It's just what I've read and what I've heard is that they don't cover full immersion. It's more just kind of from water damage. Hey, it slips and falls in the toilet and you grab it out really quick. They might cover that, but if it's the kind of thing where it's been sitting underwater for a significant amount of time, they can somehow recognize that, maybe based on the trip sensors, and they might not cover that. The other thing with AppleCare is you do just get two accidental damage coverages. So if it happens more than twice, they're not going to cover it on that third time. And some of the other third-party plans are a little more broad. They'll cover you for 3, 4, maybe even more issues of accidental damage. Almost all of your accidental damage coverages are going to have some sort of deductible, so you want to look into that. You are going to not just get a replacement for free. Most of them commonly, I think, seem to have about a $50 deductible, so that's going to be the price range that you're going to be looking at. And as far as third-party services, the one that I have heard most people talk about, and they were actually a sponsor and advertiser on the MacCast in the past, but I've heard pretty good ratings, and they seem to have the most convenient replacement policies in terms of you can even take it into the Apple Store and have the repair done by the Apple Store and they're going to reimburse you, and that is SquareTrade over at squaretrade.com. So look into maybe a accidental damage protection dependent upon, again, how accident prone you might be, but it may save you a lot of money in the long run. Related to that, I guess, and somewhat related to that, would be case or no case. I've always kind of been a no case person, again, up until this year when I had this damage happen. My iPhone luckily survived without too much damage. It did have the back glass break, which wasn't too costly of a repair. On my iPads, I have the Apple Smart Cover on both of them. That's not going to afford a whole lot of protection. What I like about the Smart Cover is that it's quick and easy to detach, so a lot of times I like to use my iPad without any kind of case, and the Smart Cover with those magnets just pulls off very easily. It doesn't add a lot of bulk to the device, which I really appreciate. So I really like using my devices as Apple intended, just as these beautiful, gorgeous devices. But if you're, again, the type of person who's more prone to dropping their device, you might want to look into a good case. And if you're really prone to dropping your device, I really recommend looking into the OtterBox cases. They're kind of bulky, but if you're the type of person who's going to bounce your iPhone across the floor from time to time, they're going to offer sort of the best protection. And there are a lot of different case options that cover kind of every scenario. So I really think you have to look at personally how you use your devices, how hard you are on your devices. Do you care about the back of your device? If it's an iPad, if that gets scratched up, is that going to bother you? In my case, that doesn't really bother me. And as a matter of fact, Apple's anodized backs, at least on the latest generations of iPads, seem to hold up pretty well. But they're definitely not scratch-proof. So if that's the kind of thing that you're going to worry about, you want, might want to look into a case, or at least maybe one of these films that you can put over the back. I was a huge fan of the Zag Invisible Shields. I think they're a really great product. They did really well on my iOS devices. I kind of stopped using them because I didn't like the feel of the extra layer of material on the screen. But if you're looking for the best protection, you might consider doing that as well as maybe a case on your device. Physical keyboard. I overall tend to use the on-screen keyboard. It works just fine for me, but I'm really a hunt and peck typist, and I don't use my iOS device for a lot of typing. I am using it more and more, though. I use it a lot more for doing show notes when I'm doing research and stuff like that, but I am able to use the on-screen keyboard pretty quickly. I've adapted to it pretty well, and it doesn't bother me tapping right there on the screen. But if you're the type of person who prefers a physical keyboard, maybe you're a touch typist, somebody like that, there are a lot of really great options out there. I have a lot of friends and a lot of people who swear by the new Logitech Ultra Thin keyboard cover. It has rave reviews across the board. It costs about $99 US, and it is really thin. I think it's going to be the closest thing to the Microsoft Surface Touch keyboard that they have, and a lot of people seem to really like that keyboard on that device. So you might look into that. Another option, if you're not going to be using it as frequently, because I think with this solution, it's not quite as portable, it's not quite as always there, but you could use just simply any kind of Bluetooth keyboard. I really like Apple's little wireless keyboard. I have that for using with my MacBook Pro, and I do occasionally take that with me. If I think that I'm going to be typing on the iPad and doing it quite a bit, then I will grab that. And I have the InCase Origami Workstation case, which is this really cool case for the Apple keyboard that then folds around and becomes a little iPad stand, so you can put your iPad up against it either in portrait or landscape mode, and that works really well for sort of converting your iPad into almost like a laptop, a notebook for certain uses. And that's from InCase. I don't remember the price on that product. I think it was around $40, and I picked it up at the Apple store. But that is a good solution if you're not going to be using a physical keyboard extensively. But I think if you're going to be using it a lot, you might want to look into one of the keyboard case solutions that's out on the market. Another thing to consider with your new iOS device is going to be adapters for the Lightning connector. Specifically, if you have older accessories, you probably want to consider looking into the Lightning to 30-pin adapter. That's $29 from Apple. They also have a cable version that is $39, and that adds a little longer cable. So if you need to extend that adapter away from the Lightning connector for whatever reason, you might want to go with that solution. And it supports a couple things with older devices that I think are particularly useful. It supports analog and USB audio, as well as syncing and charging. So if you have some older speaker docks, that can be really handy, and almost become a critical accessory if you don't want to have to buy new speaker docks. The one thing to note about that is if you have a really old speaker dock that uses the FireWire pins for charging, that is not supported through the Lightning to 30-pin adapter. So it does need to support USB charging. And also, if your docking device has video out, the 30-pin to Lightning adapter does not support video out. The Lightning connector itself does do video out, but you need the appropriate Lightning to video adapter. It's not that older style video out that came in the 30-pin. iPod out is another feature that isn't supported by the adapter, and this is the feature that allows you to use head units and other devices as a screen, so you can kind of send the iPod information out to an external screen. A lot of cars different cars and head units had that feature. If your head unit supports iPod out, that's not going to be supported by the Lightning to 30-pin adapter. What is supported, though, is USB audio in and out. So the old 30-pin microphones like the Blue Mikey Digital should continue to work through the adapter. and that can be really handy. So again, if you have some of those older accessories, if you want to support some of your older 30-pin devices, you might consider looking into that Lightning to 30-pin adapter. On the video side, if you need to do video out, they have the Lightning to AV adapter, which is going to allow you to do HDMI connection. So if you have HDTV you want to hook up your iOS device to, that is a really handy adapter. Also the Lightning to VGA adapter if you're hooking up to maybe an older projector and you want to do presentations with your iPad or your iPhone. Now I do have to say with these adapters, I've found less and less of a need for them now that Apple supports the AirPlay mirroring. So very often when I'm giving a presentation, what I'll do is I'll hook up my MacBook Pro to the projector using just the mini DisplayPort adapter, and then I use a software tool like Reflection, or actually they just changed the name of that app. It's now called Reflector. The Reflector app, which lets me go AirPlay video from my iOS device over to my MacBook, which would be hooked up to the projector, and I get it onto the projector that way. Same kind of thing with my HDTV. I have an Apple TV, so I can actually use AirPlay to either mirror or send my video signal over to the television. And I like not being hardwired, but if you want a hardwire solution, which can tend to be a little bit more reliable, you might look into one of the Lightning to video adapters. And then I noticed the Apple stores, this was something that was only available in Europe until recently, but the Apple stores now in the US are carrying the Lightning to micro USB adapter. So this is cool because it'll allow you to use a micro USB cable to charge your device. And a lot of other third-party accessories have standardized on the micro USB cable, so you might already have that in your bag, and that could make it more convenient for charging. The one thing you need to know about the micro USB connector, though, is it is limited in terms of the wattage that it can deliver. So even if you have something like Apple's new wall charger, which I think is a 12-watt adapter, with the micro USB connector, it's only going to draw 5 watts of power, which means that your device is going to charge a little bit slower. It's going to charge more like if you hooked it directly up to your computer, which is charging at a slower rate. And for something like the iPad with Retina display, that usually wants 10 watts of power, so it's going to charge at half the speed, so it can take a bit longer through the micro USB adapter, even if you have a wall charger that's outputting more wattage. So just be aware of that if you're going to go with that adapter. But that adapter is really nice because it's nice and tiny. So if you're looking for ultimate portability, you might consider looking into that solution. And then the other thing that I really like and was probably the best accessory that I had with my original iPad and iPhone was Apple's camera connection kit. The camera adapters that will allow you to plug in an SD card to pull images off of your maybe digital SLR camera, which is the one that I used it most frequently with, or the USB adapter that allows you to plug in either your camera or other USB accessories directly into your device. Well, Apple now has Lightning versions of both of those adapters. There's the Lightning to SD card reader, as well as the Lightning to USB camera adapter. And the USB adapter is really handy because it'll allow you to hook up other kind of MIDI devices, some USB keyboards if they're low power, they don't require a lot of power, and some USB microphones. Again, if they don't draw a lot of power, you can plug a USB mic, put that into GarageBand, and actually do recording directly from those devices through that adapter on your iPad. And that is really cool and handy in a lot of situations, but I mostly use it for the camera adapter. So the SD camera card reader is the one that I probably use most frequently. The one thing that I realized, I bought both of these adapters and I think they're $29 US each, so not cheap. And I already had the Lightning to, or I already had the 30-pin camera adapters. I realized after the fact, you know, I probably could have just bought the one Lightning to 30-pin adapter and then used my old camera connection kit adapters. And that I have to be carrying sort of double the adapters, but I still am in this case now because I have, you know, the two different cables, the Lightning to SD card reader and the Lightning to USB camera adapter. So, you know, consider that. You might be able to save a little bit of money, especially if you have already the 30-pin adapters for your iOS devices. And so that's kind of it on some of the accessories and things like that. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is what I consider to be my must-have apps for all of my iOS devices. Now, I'm going to let you guys know what these are because people ask me about it all the time. But really, mine are pretty specific to the kinds of things that I do on my iOS devices. And that is doing research and taking notes and working with different documents related to producing the podcast and also a little bit to doing programming and my web development business. So I have to sign contracts and send those back and forth. So you're going to kind of see a slant towards those sorts of applications in terms of my must-have applications. So you might ask your friends and family who have similar interests or might use their devices for similar reasons what kind of applications they like. But here's sort of my list because people have asked. So Reader, the RSS reading application that integrates with my Google Reader subscriptions, absolutely critical, and that's R-E-E-D-E-R. I have Reader on both my Mac and my iOS devices. That's how I get all my news. That's how I aggregate everything related to keeping up to date with all of the news and events and that are happening from all the different sources that I want to follow. Related to that, for longer form articles, I like to save those off into an offline reader. I use Pocket for that, which is what used to be Read Later. It's now at getpocket.com. Great application. I really like the user interface, and it's sort of replaced Instapaper for me, although I do still have Instapaper installed on my iOS devices, and I do use that one occasionally as well. Send stuff over there. And what's great about Pocket and Instagram is they're both integrated with Reader. So as I'm going through my RSS feeds, if I come across an article and I say I want to save that for later, it's a longer form article, something that I want to dig into a little bit deeper, I can just hit one button and boom, send that off to either of those applications. And that really is convenient. As I mentioned, I work with PDFs a lot. And so my PDF reading application is Goodreader. Great application. It has tons of functionality I don't use. One of the critical pieces is the fact that I can access Dropbox. So it has Dropbox integration, and I can go out and I can save PDF documents there. I can also pull those back. And then if I need to work with those PDF documents, even though Goodreader has some ability to do annotations and editing and stuff like that, I find its interface a little bit clunky. So they are a sponsor of the MacCast, but they make the best PDF editing and annotating application for the Mac, in my opinion, and that is Smile Software. So PDF Pen for iPad and iPhone, as I told you earlier in the ad, they're on sale right now. So grab them while you can, while they're cheap, but they're essential applications for me. I use those on a weekly basis, so I'm throwing stuff in there, specifically more for my web development business. Again, I have to sign contracts, I have to read PDFs and work with those and send them back to clients. So I use PDF Pen both on the Mac and on my iOS devices for doing that. And sort of, you can tell already related to that, Dropbox is integrated into my workflow for the stuff that I do. So I definitely have to have Dropbox on my iOS devices. That gives me access to all my documents when I'm on the go. And then a couple of social things. Tweetbot, that's what I use for doing Twitter. I do have Twitter installed on my iOS devices, but that's mainly because that brings the iOS integration directly into iOS 6. So Twitter's on there just so I can access those features and functionality. But when I'm actually going through my Twitter feed and stuff like that, I'm using the Tweetbot application. That's become my favorite in terms of the user interface. Google Authenticator. This is a little application, and it just allows me to work with Google's two-factor authentication. I started using that when we had the whole Matt Hoehn incident this year, where he had his Google account hacked, and I wanted a little bit more security. I think we talked about that on the show a little bit, and so I switched over to Google's two-factor authentication. So anytime I log into a Google product, Google Plus or Google Reader, I have to authenticate by entering a code, and I get that code from my iOS device using the Google Authenticator application. Also related to security, I, as you know, I'm a big 1Password user, so related to that password security, I have passwords that are different for every service and everything that I log into, and I use 1Password to manage all of that. So I absolutely have to have 1Password on all of my iOS devices, otherwise I don't know what my logins are. So that is a critical application from AgileBits, and you know, I recommend everybody be using 1Password just for better security across the board, whether on your Mac or on the web or on your iOS devices. It is just, for me, it's become a critical part of how I operate my devices and my Mac. And then, and working with text and documents, I have told you that I have moved mostly to a workflow using just text files and Markdown. And my favorite application for working with that is Byword, something David Sparks turned me on to. And I think it's an absolutely fabulous application. What I really like about it is just the simplicity. It's not overly complex. It's really easy to work with your text documents and your Markdown files and get the preview that you want to see. So bywordapp.com is where you can find that. And for my web development and programming, when I do have to do that on my iPad, I don't do it that frequently, but in a pinch, if I need to edit a document, I like to have something that has code highlighting and support for the different languages, whether it be HTML or CSS or PHP. And the best application, in my opinion, that I found for that is Textastic. Textasticapp.com is where you can grab that one. So if you're working with code or if you're heavily working with text files, take a look at that app. iBooks, I'm starting to do more and more reading on my iOS devices, and just for the convenience and integration with everything on iOS, I have iBooks for that. I do have Amazon's Kindle app installed, although I haven't purchased a single Kindle book yet, probably because I don't have a Kindle hardware device. I know a lot of people, though, if you have a Kindle, you probably want to grab the Kindle application so that you can read those on your iOS devices as well. For podcasts, I've really tried to use Apple's podcast application, but it just has too many bugs and too many quirks. It has not worked out well for me. I know they're working on improving it, but Downcast I use on a daily basis when I'm out and about listening to podcasts. I love the fact that I can stream or download from my feed, and I can really control in a lot of ways what's going on. I love the fact that they have multiple skip back time frames and skip forward options. It also fully supports enhanced podcasts, which, being a person who produces enhanced podcasts, I want to be able to see the chapter titles. I want to be able to see the chapter list. Apple got rid of that with the iOS application, and I'm hoping they bring it back at some point, but it's just, in my opinion, not as good. So if you're looking for a more full-featured podcast application, take a look at Downcast. I also have flip-flop back and forth between that and Instacast from time to time, but Downcast has become sort of my default application. And I do like the fact also that it supports protected feeds. So you can plug in your credentials if you've subscribed to a podcast that uses authentication. You can do that right from within those applications. And you can kludge that into Apple's app, but they don't make it easy. So take a look at Downcast if you're looking for a podcatcher on your iOS device. And on video entertainment, Netflix. I'm a huge Netflix watcher and subscriber, so Netflix has to be installed on my iOS device. I also use Amazon Prime, so the fact that Amazon Prime now has a video application, that now does get installed on at least all of my iPads. And then occasionally I do like to watch stuff from PBS, and I have to say the PBS application for watching video, that is a fabulous app. They've done a really nice job with that. So if you're a fan of PBS and you watch those programs, you definitely want to grab that device or that application for your device as well. And then again, going back to my web development business, I do occasionally need to log back into my Mac when I'm out and about on my iOS devices, or I might need to log into one of my web servers and things like that. On the Mac side of things, there's a lot of different applications. I've used VNC and the VNC that's built into Mac OS X, and I can, you know, I'm pretty technical, so I know how to set that up. I know how to get it running. I think we've covered it a few times on the MacCast, how you can set that up for yourself. But just for sheer ease of use, log me in Ignition. I purchased that application. I think they've changed the subscription policy, so I might be grandfathered in. I remember when I bought it, it was like $15. You bought the application that allowed you to use it to remotely control and get back to your Mac. I don't know if you need to subscribe to the service now. I think you might, but I bought the application, and what I love about it is it's just so easy to get in. I just install the software on my Mac. I don't have to do any firewall setup. I didn't have to do any configuration. As long as I have it up and running on my Mac and my Mac's connected to the internet and I can get an internet connection on my iOS device, I can get back. I can remotely control my Mac and get access to stuff. And I have to be honest, I've had to use that a few times in a pinch to move a file over to Dropbox that maybe I forgot to put in there, things like that. It's really convenient and handy for doing. So even if there is... even if you have to pay a small amount monthly for that kind of service, if you just don't want to deal with the hassle of having to set that up on your own, it's probably worth looking into. And then for remotely accessing my web servers and doing web development and stuff like that, I use Secure Shell, so SSH, and my favorite client for that, if you're looking for something, is ISSH, although I have heard good things about Panic's Prompt application, and I do know that that is currently on sale, so I'm thinking about going over and picking that up. I actually got notified by that by Appler, and if you haven't checked it out, you can go to getappler.com. That's a new service being developed by Michael Johnston, who I do the We Have Communicators podcast for, and it's a social kind of application, web application for finding and discovering iOS applications. So just like we're talking about now, some of my favorite applications, you can go through my list, see what I use on my iOS devices, and I can go in there and comment and rate different applications and let you know what's good and what's not good. So if you'd like to follow me over there, head over to getappler.com and click on the sign up, and the sign up code you want to use is simply MacCast, and you can get in. It's currently in private beta if you'd like to join us over there. So do that. And then finally, just a couple of fun applications that you might want to check out. I have a myriad of games that I really like to run on my iOS devices, probably too many and probably more than I want to admit to, but I'll give you a couple of my current favorites. I am totally addicted to Lauren Brichter's Letterpress, just a totally fun and awesome word game. And then Half Brick Studios makes, a lot of people know Fruit Ninja. Fruit Ninja is definitely installed on my iOS devices, and I love that application. But my current favorite is something they make called Jetpack Joyride, which is one of these runner, I think they call them a runner style application, where you see how far you can get. And you have this guy, he's in a science lab, and he gets a jetpack, and there's different kinds of jetpacks and upgrades that you can get. Just a really fun little application. And I like that one because I can just pull it up, do a quick game. You know, games last maybe a minute or two, and then you're on to the next one. I guess it depends really on how good you are. Maybe you can get a lot further than I can, but Jetpack Joyride's a lot of fun, and so check that out. And so those are a couple things if you got a new iOS device for the holidays that you might want to check out and look into. And with that, though, I think that's going to do it for today. I need to get off and get off the mic and go spend some time with my family. Hopefully that's what you're doing now for the holidays. But before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details on their products over at circusponies.com. Smile, make sure you take advantage of the discount on PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. Also check out their other software over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, you know, if you got a new device and you want to get some cash for your old product, you can head over to gazelle.com and get a quote for your old device and maybe get some cash for that. Maybe a little extra cash to take away some of the sting of money you might have spent over the holidays. So you can find information on that over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. It's been a great year. I know we've got one more episode coming before the end of the year, but I just want to say thank you. I don't say thank you to you enough for all of the support you give me, all the great comments and emails, all of the financial support for those of you who are subscribed to the member program. I really, really appreciate it. I've been able to do podcasting at least as a significant part of my income for the last few years, and that is all made possible by you, by the support of my great sponsors who come on and help me produce and do this program for you. So thank you to all of you. I hope you have a great, happy, and safe holiday season. And if you have any feedback for me, any comments, anything you want to send me, a question, you need some help with that new device or maybe new Mac that you got over the holiday season, please send your emails, your comments to MacCast mechgeeks@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and leave your voicemail messages there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype if you want to save on long distance charges. The Skype address is the MacCast. And if you want show notes, links to all of this stuff that I talked about in this episode, and there's a lot of them in this one, so you probably want to head over to maccast.com. Click on the show notes link in the blog post. And also, while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then a couple other places you can follow the community and follow me online. Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a new Google Plus community set up. So if you are on Google Plus and you want to check that out, just look for MacCast on Google Plus. And I'm sure you'll come across the Google Plus community, and we'd love to have you join us over there. But that is going to do it for now. Happy and safe holiday to you and your family. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.